Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben, and as always, we are joined with our super producer, Noel Miscellaneous Brown.
Miscellaneous. All right, that's a good one.
That's not my best work.
Junk drawer.
Oh, nice.
Noel Junk Drawer Brown. Boy, that's hard to say. Junk drawer.
Junk drawer. It's up there with rural drawer.
It is, yes.
The rural drawer's junk drawer. Oh, boy. Hey, do you, real quick, before we get started, you have a junk drawer, right?
Of course I do,
most people do.
Yeah, sure.
When I moved to my new place, I was trying to, you know, we have all those delusions when we move. We're like, this is going to be where I get my life together.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And I was like, I am going to live without a junk drawer. And I couldn't do it. I lasted maybe 6 months,
Isn't it funny how probably, I would venture a guess that 99% of everybody listening to us has a junk drawer. Their parents had a junk drawer.
Uh-huh.
It just seems to be something you can't do without in a house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. It's just simply a place to put things away. I mean, you could have a whole room. You might have a junk room.
People do.
Yeah.
People do. I can't because my apartment has like three rooms. but people do have junk rooms. The reason I was wondering about this is because growing up, one thing that I always found in junk drawers would be car keys. Two cars that maybe were older than me that I had, you know, that I had never seen. My parents may have sold the cars before, I was born, like my dad's MG, you know, and, I got really excited the year I found it because I thought, oh wow, we have a secret garage.
Yeah. He's storing this away for me probably, right?
Yeah. Oh man. Kids are so narcissistic.
Wouldn't that be cool? And you know, you find like old house keys, you find rubber bands.
Yeah.
But those car keys, you know, here's an interesting thing though. It seems like now, with car keys being what they are, you know, with the fobs and the, you know, the electronics that go along with the key.
Yeah.
It seems that when you sell a vehicle, you make a pretty good effort to find that second set of keys because most people have two keys, one spare that they keep at home in the junk drawer or wherever.
Right.
And then one they always carry with them or maybe give it to a spouse or something like that.
Right,
but,
yeah.
It seems like maybe, the days of finding old car keys are going to be gone soon, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. And it's weird when you think about it, that key technology in general is going to be something that within your lifetime, listener, is going to change drastically. Will car keys be the new, like, laser disc or floppy disc? And did we talk about this? I think you and I have talked about this before.
I feel like we've talked about the price of car keys before, how expensive it is.
They are super expensive. But this is just a side note on, on a word processor, like Microsoft Word or something.
Yeah.
It hit me, and maybe we've talked about this on air, Scott, but it hit me that a lot of kids don't know what that icon above the save button is.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because it is a floppy disk, right?
Right, and no one uses it. And are keys going to be also obsolete later on? I mean, at least for cars, that's the direction it's going, for sure.
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah. I think keys are going to dramatically change over the next few years, just as just about everything in the automobile is changing right now. It seems like development, it's rapid right now. It's happening way faster than it did in the past. The changes, the developments we've seen, like in, I mean, simple things like infotainment and even, the readouts on the driver's display, the dash, steering wheel controls, things like that. All that stuff is changing so quickly and the way that you control it, you know, whether it's a single joystick, you know, or a single, it almost looks like a mouse in the middle that you can control it with, or if it's touch screens or whatever, you know, all this is changing. Keys are changing at an equally fast rate.
You know, it's so strange when we think about that evolution, because I might get dinged a little for saying this, but probably one of the slowest degrees of change has been material science, because it's been a steady incremental rise.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But in every other case, it's almost like Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point. You know, it seems like just, you know, you look at a car from 10 years ago, right? And boom, it's radically different.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's right. It appears dramatically different from, what was the year that we said, we typically go to? Is it 2010 or is it 2005? Where it seems like there was one point where cars just dramatically increased in the amount of technology that was inside the vehicle.
Right.
It seems like everything hit at once.
In terms of tech, I think it's 2010 probably.
Yeah.
And of course, this stuff was still happening in luxury cars. years and years and years before, but I think 2010 is when we really start to see mass production.
I guess what I'm talking about is like, you know, the inclusion of things like electronic stability control and every car must have front airbags, rollover bags, you know, the side curtain bags, bags in the airbags in the seats. Mm-hmm. We see airbags in seat belts now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point where dramatically just takes off. You're right. It's like that tipping point, as you said.
Oh. Scott, it just occurred to me.
We're not talking about junk drawers today.
we've just, our segue, our usual intro has gone on so long. We haven't talked at all about what this show is, but that's because we're actually doing the very first episode of, Nuts and Bolts 2016.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And it's been a long, long time since we've done one.
Man,
I think it was April of 2015.
Yeah.
The last time we did that. Now, along the way, we do bring up listener mail, of course, and some suggestions. And we've been creating these massive lists of, you know, possible topics and, you know, kind of going back and forth with listeners about what they know about certain things, you know, as far as what they want to hear on these podcasts. So I think we've been pretty successful throughout 2015 bringing listener suggestions to the air.
Yeah, I would like to say so. You know, listeners, as we often say, our best suggestions come from you. And we get such a grab bag of cool stuff, the occasional kind correction.
Occasional.
And we also get these really great things that are fascinating, yet maybe too short to be an episode on their own.
True.
Just like a junk drawer, you got a bunch of little stuff that doesn't really go anywhere else.
Yeah, sure. Right. Yep. But it's something interesting you want to hang on to anyways. And that's kind of the way we look at a Nuts and Bolts episode. So there's a few things here that, are kind of like stuff Scott sees, maybe some stories or something I've got from, you know, the last several months now at this point that I've been kind of collecting. But we've also got a lot of, listener suggestions, some more of those from Facebook, from email. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tackle this in a slightly different way today than I normally do. See, what we normally do is we come in here with a giant stack of email and I try to highlight and read, a lot of the notes from the people that, you know, have sent them in. They've taken a long time to craft them. So I figure, well, we'll give them their airtime and read them and let everybody know what they're thinking. This time, I think we're going to try to burn through several of these. So I've got maybe, I'm going to say 10 or 12 of each one from Facebook, from email. And I've got some like an article to go over from Popular Mechanics here. Again, some stories, just kind of a general feel for what people are asking for is what we're going to do today.
Yeah. And we've also got some news. We've got some, interesting, tidbits, a little bit of weird stuff. And statistically speaking, the odds are fairly high that at some point I will go on a rant about something. Just, I'm not planning it. I don't know what we're going to run into.
Well, we look forward to it.
We'll see, man. We'll see.
Every time.
So, what's up first?
All right. We'll tell you what. Let's look at a few Facebook suggestions. Now, I did find a way to search the messages in Facebook finally, so I'll show you how to do that later, Ben. But it was a mystery to me for a while. I finally figured it out. It was pretty easy, and it allowed me to dig some stuff up from the very end of last year, which is great, and even farther back. I've got more than just these, by the way. So if you wrote to us and had a suggestion, I guarantee you that I've read it. I guarantee you that I've put it on a list.
Uh-huh.
It's just I'm not maybe going to get to it today in this list because we have limited space. But here's a few of the highlights, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So Miles D wrote in September of 2015. And Ben, I think we'll just stick to first name, last initial. How about that?
Yeah, that's probably the best way to go.
Anonymity, right?
And if
right,
if we run into another Miles D, we'll call him Miles D 2.
Okay, we'll do that.
If we run into three, then something weird is happening.
Something's got to change. All right, so Miles D wrote in September of 2015, and he wanted to us to talk about the rotary powered Corvette concept from 1970, and this is a fantastic idea. It's something that I've posted about on Facebook, and well, I'll just briefly tell you a little bit about it. 1970, it was a concept car from General Motors. GM had an entire rotary program. It was in place, which a lot of people don't even know about. And this was authorized by John DeLorean, who was Chevrolet's, the Chevy division's GM at that point.
Uh-huh.
So he authorized this whole program. And I think it was the fuel crisis maybe that bit into what they were planning to do. But they had a four-rotor Corvette that was a mid-engine Corvette scheduled to come out in the 1970s. I think it was scheduled actually for production around... Well, I, you know what? Not this one specifically. Here's the weird twist in this.
Okay.
That one kind of, you know, arrived and then went away because the rotary program left or was killed off. They took that exact same car, that mid-engine car, and they put a 400 cubic inch V8 in it and called it the AeroVet. And I think it was around 1977. And then in 1980, that one was scheduled for production. They were going to actually produce a mid-engine Corvette in 1980. And for whatever reason, there was like a guard change at General Motors around that time. And those guys decided they were going to kill that whole program off as well. So, big changes for Corvette around that time era. And we didn't get to see any of the rotary engines really come out in, the production vehicles from GM that, that should have really. Okay. Second one. Ryan A wrote in August of 2015 and wanted to hear about the, Ryan is from Hawaii. And, wrote in and wanted to hear about the Mitsubishi Lancer Evolution series cars. And he specifically owns a 2014 GSR, said that he bought it just before he moved to Hawaii. And he said he gets the same kind of rush out of driving that car as he does driving his motorcycle. So, you know,
that's high praise.
Well, it is. And you know what? I see these on the road a lot. We've talked about the Evolution vehicles a few times on this show. But we've never done a full show on just that vehicle. And, I think it's worthwhile, of course.
Yeah, I think we could do a whole show on this because if you look at it, it's got some scoot to it and the specs are pretty pleasing.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's a good looking vehicle. A lot of people are, I guess, super fans of the Evolution series. So, yeah, definitely we'll get to that. It's on the list.
Yeah, definitely. We have to do that one.
All right. So you want me to go through a couple more here or chime in with anything at any time? Okay. How about that?
Okay.
All right. So, this next one comes from Yijun C, and Yijun wrote in, and I think it was in August, the end of August of 2015, from Melbourne, Australia.
Melbourne.
Yeah, I shouldn't say Melbourne.
That's the one that we have managed to correctly pronounce
until today. But you corrected me, so thank you for doing that. And Yijun wrote in and said that they would like to hear about the shooting brake design. I think this is a good idea. We've done specific types of vehicles before, like shapes of vehicles before, and I think this is a good example of something that we should cover because there's a lot out there. There's the Ferrari FF, which is making or has made news recently. There's the BMW M coupes, the Z3 coupes, Mercedes-Benz CLA class. They've got a shooting brake. There have been some concept cars that have actually called themselves the shooting brake. There's a lot out there going back through history. As well as some modern versions. So I think that's a fantastic idea. Next one is from Bob M, wrote in September of 2015. And, this is an interesting question. This could almost be one of our,
mystery shows.
Yeah, mystery show, like the no prep type shows that we do.
Yeah.
Bob wanted to hear us talk about the cheapest running car you ever bought.
For how long?
Well, the cheapest running car. So you're not like picking up a car that, is $100, but you have to tow it home.
You're not buying some for parts.
No, this is a cheapest running car. Now his example that he says, and he's got more detail than this, and we'll talk about it when we get to the show, but, his example is a $75 1965 Mercury Comet four door that he bought.
Ooh.
And, kept it for a while, but I'll save the details for later,
okay.
But be thinking about that. Your cheapest running car that you've ever bought, throughout your motoring history.
Yeah, I'm going to hold off because I think I know the answer already.
Okay.
And you may have heard of it before, but boy, just thinking of that thing makes me feel like my life is in danger. It was running, but it was running wild, man.
Yeah, it was worth every penny is what you're saying.
Both pennies, yeah.
All right. Here's one from Jason G, and Jason wrote in at the end of August and on Facebook and said, this is a good one too, Ben. You're going to like this one, I think. Surveillance vehicles and cool surveillance gadgetry that goes along with them for automobiles, vans, whatever.
Oh yeah.
That's a fantastic idea.
How have we not done that?
I don't know. I think Jason says that he himself is a private investigator, and would have a fascination in this type of thing and probably some inside knowledge, of course. But this would be kind of our chance to talk about, bleeding edge technology of what's out there. Some of the old school stuff, maybe that, you know, the ways that they did it.
Like sitting in the van.
Yeah, the vans.
By the curb.
Yeah, like the vans that say, like, definitely a florist on the side. But have the big satellite dish. You know, there's so many spoofs of this in television and in movies.
Yeah.
And, just in popular culture, I think that, you know, it would be fun to do that and to, you know, take a real look at it as well. Like what you can go out and get. If you are a private investigator.
Like, or as a civilian.
Yeah, too. Exactly right. So do you have to have licenses to get that stuff?
Yeah, and what specific gadgetry is used there? But this could also be, not necessarily private investigator stuff. Let us not forget that the Google Maps crew, that's surveillance as well.
Oh, that's true.
You know, they're driving around so you can get the street view. They have those vans that drive around with a camera mounted on it, and you can go online. This is a family show, so if you have kids, you might not want to check on this with them in the area. But you can go online and see the people that have been caught doing various things on the street while the Google car drove by.
Sure, they get word that it's going to pass by at a certain time and stage a scene. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, stage a scene.
You know what, you're making me think, and this is a tangent, so but I guess this is what the show is all about, right?
Right.
So. And I've got sketchy details on this because I just read the story this morning, and it was in Popular Science. It's about the 2016 Olympics, and the 2016 Olympics are happening in Rio de Janeiro, I think, in Brazil. And they are going to station 4 cameras overhead over Rio de Janeiro that will record the entire city. And you may think that's impossible. There's no way to do it. But you can look it up in Popular Science and figure out what they're going to do with this. But these are surveillance cameras that are so massive, like that have such a wide view. The only way, I think they weigh 40 pounds each. They're going to put them in balloons, tethered balloons.
Okay.
And I think the purpose is kind of an anti-terrorism thing, you know, but it really is reactionary. They're going to be able to, they'll be able to monitor, but they'll also be able to, track people back because you can zoom in. This is crazy.
Okay.
4 of these cameras will cover the entire city. That's how wide it is.
That's just nuts, man.
The people that are monitoring it can zoom in to follow people or vehicles to or from wherever they're going. However, whatever they're zooming in to watch represents I think they said 1/10,000th of the view that is current, that is available and being recorded at all times.
So then the question would be, are they responsible then for other crimes that are going to occur? Because, you know, it's a big pickpocketing city.
It is. And also, I believe, and I'm going to go on a limb here, but I thought I heard something about kidnapping as well. That's a huge, that's a profitable industry there.
Yeah, kidnapping.
Just petty crimes, too. I mean, it's going to be hit. There's also going to be hit and runs. There's going to be all kinds of stuff that's happening. But I think the main focus is, and I mean, hate to say it, but this is going to be the focus of the world for a while, Rio de Janeiro. It might be a target, right?
Yeah.
So if something does happen, they will be able to trace back, you know, they'll be able to watch in reverse where these people came from exactly, get an ID on the person, get an ID on the vehicle, and watch them. I mean, they'll be able to watch them come and go from the scene. So it's really a great tool. But is it overreaching? It, you know, probably is. The field of view of this thing, of these things is just going to be incredible. I mean, huge. And like I said, it's always recording the entire thing, no matter what they're watching specifically.
That is surprising to me. We live in a brave new world. We are absolutely going to cover surveillance gadgetry, Jason.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can't not do it. I love this idea so much. There's another story that kind of relates to this that I wanted to tell you guys about really quickly.
All right. Let's have it.
This story is something that we ran into on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And I think it will apply to cars very soon if it doesn't already. And that is the Stingray phone tracker. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
This is a surveillance device that was first for just the military and intelligence. Now state and local law enforcement have this, the various kind of devices. So what it does is it mimics a cell phone tower. So all nearby mobile phones or other, you know, Wi-Fi enabled wireless data devices like a tablet or something, they all connect to it and it can read what they're doing. It can take data from off the phone.
Oh boy.
And, there's not really any way that the average person would stop it. It can turn off the phone. It can track the phone. So when I think of this, I also think of what we're talking about with increasingly computerized cars. So as you and I and everybody driving newer cars gets a car that's closer and closer to a rolling computer, then what's going to happen is we're going to end up having more and more personal information stored on it. Not just where you go and when, but also, you know, all your contacts.
Well, people already pair phones to cars just for simple Bluetooth activity, right?
Yes.
So that's very, very easy to be. So the car then could act as a pass-through device to another, to one of these Stingray devices.
Exactly.
Well, that's interesting. That's a crazy thing. What's it called? Stingray?
Stingray. The Stingray is an IMSI catcher. So International Mobile Subscriber Identity.
Wow. Catcher. And there's no way to detect when this is being used nearby. So you don't know if it's
not for the average phone user. Yeah.
Wow.
Because it's supposed to be mimicking a cell tower.
But yeah, absolutely. That could definitely affect the way, people driving newer modern cars that are connected to the cloud, you know, that have, just the Internet of Things, I guess.
I can see what a useful tool that would be in the case of organized attacks. Like, let's say there are a bunch of,
You mean in defeating organized attacks?
Yes.
Okay.
There are better words for it, but I almost called them a bunch of jerks planning to, bomb Rio de Janeiro or something. And they're planning over electronic devices. The Stingray technology would make it much easier to find and prevent that plan. Right?
You know, it's funny that it's almost like you would say, "Well, why wouldn't they just install that everywhere throughout the city and then they'll know, right?" But then again, the second you say that, then you realize you don't want people listening. I mean, it goes right to the heart of. Privacy issues and what people, and I don't want any of that stuff. I mean, I don't like regulations. I don't like all that, you know, anybody listening to what I'm doing, even though it's very boring, but I don't want anybody listening to that. I mean, I think this is a huge, huge issue, and the surveillance topic is going to be a fun one to do, I think, the whole thing.
Oh, yes. So before we go too far into it, because I can tell that.
Well, that's a very incomplete argument on my part. Sorry.
Oh, no, I see both sides of it. It's continuing, and we're going to look further in depth on that too when we do an episode just on this. I wanted to talk a little bit about something that I think is kind of sad in the news.
Oh yeah. Okay. What's that?
Mercedes is killing off the AMG sport name to make everything Mercedes AMG now.
Oh my gosh. Okay. You told me this, right before we went on air and
sorry,
I was shocked.
Sorry.
No, yeah. I mean, it was like 15 minutes before we started recording. I didn't know this was happening. You know, at this point when this airs, probably it'll be old news maybe, but tell me what's happening. Like what's going on? Cause I don't quite understand where the break is going to happen.
Right. Okay. So
cause they're still going to use the AMG name, right?
Yeah. So in the last few years, Mercedes has been using the AMG sport name to describe, what Jalopnik calls near beer AMG cars. It was confusing, but the AMG sports models were a step up from the more basic Benzes, but not quite full on AMG cars.
Okay. You know what this is already reminding me of?
What's that?
This is the, BMW M badged cars versus the BMW M cars.
Oh man.
It's exactly the same, isn't it?
It's pretty much, you're not wrong because check this out. They've got this new naming scheme, right? So this naming scheme will abandon the AMG tradition, you know, one man, one engine, and it'll make these AMG badged cars more affordable. So, the current, like the C450 AMG starts a little over 50 grand. The C63 AMG starts around 65 grand. So is this brand dilution? I ask you, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I looked into, some of the AMG forums and you can imagine the reaction people are having, especially a lot of the more traditionalist people.
Yeah. I'll definitely check that out today. Cause I bet they're pretty hot under the collar right now, about what's going on.
Right. You can imagine it'll be worth your time, but there are people who are saying, you know, like my car just dropped thousands of dollars in value.
Yeah. Well, did it though? I mean,
I don't know, man.
I'm not sure. Maybe the ones that will be produced will be worth less, but
likely.
Yeah, that's probably it. I mean, if you got one of the originals, hang on to it, right?
Right. Yeah.
Seems that way. Unless I'm misreading this story. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know. We'll see what happens, but it's weird because you make the excellent point comparing this with BMW. And I said, you're not wrong, and you're not. And I wonder how far this stuff can continue as since more and more large car companies are buying smaller, you know, maybe we could call them boutique or niche cars, and then taking a lot of what makes them unique and then just turning it into a logo rather than the performance.
Yeah, taking the specialty tuner name and applying it to your product, even though it's really just a badge and maybe some special stitching inside on the seats,
right,
and steering wheel.
There's a trim package.
That's right. A different intake and exhaust maybe or something like that. I don't know. But it's an interesting idea. And man, I was shocked by the news, but we'll see what happens with this. And again, I haven't read anything about it yet, so maybe I don't have a full grasp of exactly what's happening. I hope I didn't sound too jumbled up there because it's all brand new to me right now, but we'll dig into it. And maybe that's another topic for, you know, a future show too.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on with that. And maybe we'll even tie in the M cars and the M badged cars as well.
Well, let me lighten it up a little bit.
Sure.
Before we go to some emails.
Yeah.
All right. Noel, if I could have a cool sound cue for one of my favorite parts of the show, wacky driving laws.
Ah, wacky driving laws.
Okay. So, look, you're in Massachusetts. Let's say you're driving in Massachusetts, right?
Oh, I thought you were telling me the name of the town. I thought it was Urine, Massachusetts. No, I'm kidding.
It might be one. All right. So let's say, you listener are in Massachusetts and you're driving and you see a gorilla hitchhiking.
A gorilla hitchhiking. Okay.
Yeah.
This, I feel like I'm on like the Tonight Show, and I'm Ed McMahon, a gorilla hitchhiking.
with or without, a person, you really shouldn't get the gorilla in your car, or at least it has to ride shotgun, because in the state of Massachusetts, whether or not you own it, it is illegal to have a gorilla in the backseat.
Illegal to have a gorilla in the backseat. Now how long has this rule been on the books? And is there an indication of where that came from?
There's
when the circus came to town or something?
You know, I'm being specific with a gorilla, but the actual law reads this way. No person shall transport an animal in the back of a motor vehicle in a space intended for a load on the vehicle on a public way unless such space is enclosed or has side and tail racks to a height of at least 46 inches extending vertically from the floor. The animal is cross-tethered to the vehicle, protected by a secured container or cage, or otherwise protected in a manner which will prevent the animal from being thrown, from falling, or jumping from the vehicle. So not just a gorilla, which is fun for the sake of argument.
I like it your way better.
But also, you know, you can't put your dog in the backseat, which to me, I get the safety thing, but that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a little bit much, I think. You know, it's funny. Okay.
Yeah.
This kind of leads into something I'd like to talk about in a roundabout way.
Okay. Yeah.
My in-laws were in town this last weekend over the holidays. It was, as we said, we were recording this in the early part of 2016.
Uh-huh.
They were here just after the new year. And, I can't even believe I'm going to mention this part, but, I have a different story to get to here, but.
Okay.
He was telling me, my father-in-law was telling me about a time when they were in Cancun, Mexico recently, the last time, a few years ago, really. And they were walking onto the property of the hotel, and there's a guy sitting below a palm tree or, you know, whatever kind of tree it was. And right next to him, sitting on the ground next to him, is a gorilla.
What?
A live gorilla, like you'd see at the zoo, a giant live gorilla.
They're just hanging out?
You know what he's doing? He's trying to get people to come over and take photographs with the gorilla for money. So, as they're walking down this road, he's like, no, that can't be it. You know, he thinks he's seeing things like, yeah, you know, I'm too much tequila or whatever, you know, and the guy starts calling to him. He's like, hey, senor, come over here, take a picture with the gorilla,
where,
you know,
and this gorilla.
And I don't know. That's what I kept asking him. And he said, you know what? It just sat there the whole time. It was very placid. It didn't move. And it was real though. It was a real deal. It wasn't a guy. Cause I asked, I said, it wasn't a guy in a gorilla suit, was it? And he said, no, it wasn't that. And it wasn't a fake. It was real. And so, you know, they walked over and they got sort of close, but not too close because you don't want to get too close to a real live gorilla and it's not in a cage. And the guy is trying, again, prompting him to take this photograph. And he says, no. And so, you know, he starts to ask his wife, you know, my mother-in-law, if she would like her photograph with it. And she says, she also declines, and they, you know, just find it very interesting and, you know, like, well, that's a crazy story. And they walk, start to walk away. And the guy says, say goodbye to the nice lady. And the gorilla flips them the bird.
What?
Yeah. It's like his little trick. Like if they won't buy the thing, he says, say goodbye to the nice lady. And he flips them the bird as they walk away. And that was it. That was the end of the story. Nothing else to tell.
Weird.
But isn't that strange? I think, you know, you wouldn't have got the bird if you'd taken the photograph, but, strange that gorillas would come up, twice in the same week for me anyways.
Well, all right. Let's say you're outside of Massachusetts. I'll pepper these throughout the show.
Okay.
You're outside of Massachusetts. You have gotten away with the gorilla and you're dropping the gorilla off in Illinois. And you hit a deer and, somebody walks by and says, oh man, I would take that deer home and eat it if I was up to date on my child support payments. Because you see, Scott,
what?
Only residents who don't owe child support, who have not had their wildlife privileges suspended anywhere in the U.S. can claim possession of roadkill in Illinois.
No kidding.
No kidding.
That is a weird law.
No fooling.
You can't claim possession of roadkill in Illinois if you're not current on your child support.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a weird one, Ben, but I think we were, okay, with my gorilla side note out of the way now.
Right.
Because I had to say it once it came up.
Real the, issues.
Say goodbye to the nice lady story. this is maybe one of the cooler things that my father-in-law told me while he was here. He's only here for a couple of days, but,
okay.
We started talking about old cars. He saw my project car in the garage. And he used to work for Chrysler a long, long time ago. And in 1965, he worked for Chrysler Corporation. And at the time when he first started, he was driving a competitor product. Yeah, I don't know what he had, but it was not a Chrysler vehicle.
Uh-oh.
And this is still the case with Chrysler, as far as I know, because it was when I worked there too. If you don't drive a Chrysler product, you have to park in the remote part of the lot. And I mean way, way far away. It's not close. It's really not close. And if you drive a foreign make in some automotive headquarters, you know, Ford, GM, wherever.
Yeah.
Sometimes they won't even allow you to park in any of their lots. You'll have to
on
park
the property.
At least that's the way it used to be. I think maybe that was just the United Auto Workers Union lots that you couldn't park in there at all. You had to find some other remote lot and walk in. But
that makes sense to me.
But you know, it kind of does. You know, if you're going to work there, I guess buy the product and you're rewarded for buying the product.
Right,
you can park
yeah.
closer to the building.
Not
right?
necessarily the. I mean, the union attitude toward foreign makes. I get it, but
yeah.
it does. It makes more sense to me if you're saying, "Oh, you come to Ford every day. You work for Ford every day, and you're." Driving a competitor's car.
Yeah.
It's like you're taking money from us.
Yeah. So they make you park, you know, I mean, a good distance away. And I'm going to say it's, you know, like the back end of the lot, which can be really big at some of these big buildings. So it didn't take him long during the winter months to decide, well, I better, you know, step it up and get a Chrysler product.
Uh-huh.
So in 1965, he decides that he's going to buy a Plymouth Belvedere convertible. And this cool car, right? It's not a bad vehicle. I don't know anything about the engine or anything like that, but he said, you know, this is back in the day, and this is like taking you back to the way it used to be in the automotive industry in Detroit and what they did for the employees. I don't know if it's similar or not anymore. I don't think it's quite this level, but you would get a build sheet. You know, you'd order what you wanted on the vehicle,
uh-huh.
and I don't know specifically what it's called, but there's an order sheet, and you could select every option that you wanted on the vehicle. And he ordered this 65 Plymouth Belvedere convertible. And he knew the day that it was going to be produced, and it was going to be produced right there in town. It was going to go through the line because they had these production schedules. And so he knew the specific day and when and where it was going to be. So he asked his boss if he can go down and watch his car being built while it's happening. So he can go down to the factory because he's an employee.
He has
access to this, right?
Yeah.
So he does. He goes down there, and it's something that you were allowed to do. His boss said, well, take the day and go do it. And, you know, it's kind of not once in a lifetime thing, but you can do it, you know, if you want to.
That's so cool.
So he did. And, that's not the best part of this whole thing.
Huh.
So he gets down to the line and he's following his car through the steps of production, right?
Yeah.
Following all the way through. And the guy, the shop foreman or the line foreman or the supervisor or whatever. And he described him as like an Italian guy, you know, with this heavy accent, you know, when he's describing it to me, but he was saying like, oh, Eddie, this is your car. And he's like, yeah, that's my car. And he's like, well, we'll give you special treatment. And so what he does is as he walks through, this guy follows him and his car through the whole line. I don't know how long it took, maybe a couple hours,
or, yeah.
you know, maybe a long time, but this is really crazy. As he goes through the line, they do special things for him. Like when they're putting it together, you know, they see him there and he's watching everything that's happening. They welded his initials on the fender of the engine bay, like in the metal. So yeah. Cause it wasn't a robotic thing at that point. It was a handheld welder, and the welder welded his initials, into the, ED for, his initials.
Uh-huh.
So they put that in there, and then they did, when they got to the seating area, they put the better seats in, I guess, with the special stitching, it was like an upsell, I guess, at that point. So, thicker, I don't know if it's thicker or double or what it was, but
yeah.
Better seats. There was something to do with the convertible top operation, maybe it's the mechanism or something, or maybe it's the top itself. He didn't remember exactly what that was, but said that there was something special about that as well. Get this. Double paint. He ran it through the paint booth twice. Now that's something you would never get today.
No.
Cause there's a very strict limit of what they're allowed to do, but they put double paint on the body of this vehicle for him. And it was all, oh, Eddie, we'll take care of you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, the last final touch on this thing, he got a police certified speedometer put in instead of the standard speedometer. So it just said, I think it was stamped on it, said certified or something like that. But it was a police issue speedometer. So this whole vehicle was really custom. And
I
said, well, where is it? Do you know where this car is anymore? And he said, no, here's what happened. I was driving, I don't know if it's later that year or a couple of years later, someone ran a red light and he swerved to avoid that person and hit a pole or a tree or something and completely totaled it. But he ordered a second car for his mother, so that'd be my wife's grandmother, another Plymouth Belvedere, I think, but a hardtop. And that was the car that my wife drove in high school and had for a few years. But I wish we could find that car still. She had just a standard hardtop Belvedere.
Uh-huh.
But what a cool thing, huh? Can you imagine that level of not service, but individual attention, I guess, maybe, that you get when you show up and ask to see your car being built. I don't even know if they would allow you to do that anymore, unless you were inside at that specific factory.
I think you would have to have some pull. I'm sure if you're a celebrity, right?
Maybe.
That would work. Or if you're the president or something.
Yeah, and yes, I mean, I know about the whole thing where you can go and watch, plants operate. And I know that you can go to the factory in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I think you can even help build your engine for your Corvette. So I know that there's certain things similar to this, but it's not exactly like this. I mean, that was a really interesting story, I thought.
I think those are the good old days.
Yeah.
Candidly.
I think so too.
That's pretty cool though, man. Let's balance it out with, when we're talking about the good old days, let's talk about something that might be kind of weird. And I don't know if this is an entire show, but this is something that I've been keeping an eye on for a little while. And when you talked about the gas crisis earlier, it set off my spider sense, because I was going to talk about that too.
Mm-hmm.
So oil briefly, this week, fell below $30 a barrel.
Yeah, I did see that. And, I just heard about it on a little quick news blurb. But what it initially made me think of was, oh man, I'm glad I didn't buy a hybrid. and I don't know why, because
why
who knows?
That?
Well, because with price of gasoline coming down so far, it's going to make that time that it pays to, remember that whole,
how much money do you actually save?
Yeah. The trade-off
on
what you pay up front for the hybrid versus, I know that there's arguments for and against this and so many different angles, so many different levels to this,
right.
But that was my initial thought. It was like, oh man, fuel prices are coming down. Good for me. Good for us.
Huh, right. It's the initial thought is great at the gas pump. You know what I mean?
But yeah, there are consequences elsewhere.
Well, yeah, there are consequences. Oil prices have fallen. This is according to BBC by 70%. In the past 15 months.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Well, for some countries that are oil producers, this could spell a lot of trouble. So I didn't know this, Scott, at all. And this might interest you, ladies and gentlemen. Some countries look at their oil money and their oil production and come up with a price per barrel that they need to balance their budget.
Yeah, so that they can sustain their economy.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, in Russia, the finance minister of Russia said the Russian budget could only be balanced at an oil price of $82 a barrel.
$82. I heard that number as well. That was in the same news story. And so I was thinking, what is going to happen over in Russia at this point when it's down to $30 a barrel?
Right.
And is it going to continue to drop? Because I've heard people say that there's a chance that it may drop to as low as $10 a barrel.
Yeah, maybe briefly. I don't know how sustainable.
Well,
that
no,
is.
No. Then I think it starts to rebound the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So anyways, there's a lot of politics that go along with this too, but it's very interesting to watch how other economies handle this this situation. Like, well, you know, there's this real, it's a pretty delicate balancing act, really.
Oh, for
and,
sure.
And, you know, for us to be at $30 a barrel, rather, when they're sustainable only at $80 a barrel, oh man, they've got to be going through some tough times right now, but maybe, well, who knows? We'll see what happens in the next year or so.
And that got me thinking about gas prices in general. We've talked about it before, mm-hmm. right? So I went back to look at some of the average prices of gas to see what was the most expensive and what was the least expensive.
You know what I like about this?
What's that?
Whenever we say anything, like, doesn't matter when we say it's high over here in the United States, we say, oh my gosh, it was $4.50 a gallon.
I know what you're going to say.
Someone from Europe will write in and say, big deal, it's $11 a gallon here, equivalent.
Right. $9 to $11 a gallon.
Yeah, you know, based on the liter price.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Also, we'll just fast forward to the response that we give with that, which is in the U.S., being such a car culture, it's also true that there are very few reliable ways to get around other than a car. Now, granted, okay, in denser cities, there's public transit.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And there are private bus operators, right?
Yeah.
And there's also, what's next? Well, Amtrak.
Car sharing, even.
Car sharing.
You don't have to. I mean, that's starting to play into it in a bigger role now. Mm-hmm. So, there's also Uber and all those services that you can call.
I don't think you can call an Uber from here to Los Angeles.
No, probably not. No.
I bet you could.
Well,
what a weird trip.
Yeah.
That's a story for, Jalopnik or, something we could do. Like, we called an Uber. And got the guy to take us on a road trip.
Yeah, take us to Miami.
God, can you imagine how expensive that would be?
No, I can't. That person might be able to just kind of hang it up for a year or two and live the good life. That Uber driver.
Right. Well, in general, gas prices have dropped for the average American at the pump. The highest is still going to be California and Hawaii.
Yeah.
No surprise there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, about $2.82 per gallon.
Isn't that something?
Can you imagine? Cause remember it used to be like $4, $5 in some places
sure.
in California.
Yeah.
And, it also made me I wanted to ask you, what's the most you ever paid for a gallon of gas?
You know what? I'm going to say that it was probably somewhere near an airport, like trying to return a rental car.
Oh yeah, that's such a racket.
When you get close to $6 a gallon, you know, when it's really only, and at the time it was expensive elsewhere too. I mean, it was around $4 a gallon, but this would have been, I guess, around 2008, 2009, somewhere mm-hmm. in there when the prices mm-hmm. just spiked way up.
Yeah.
I'm going to say for sure it was around an airport returning a rental car. And I know that's a terrible tactic, but you know, if you get into that position where, you know, you're at a hotel and there's nothing nearby and, you know, it's right there by the airport. That's the worst place to get gas, but sometimes you just have to.
Well, yeah, because you have to turn the car in by a certain time
yeah.
and you have to have the tank filled or else it's still going to cost more if the rental company fills it up.
Well, you know, sometimes I'll just top it off with a garden hose, you know, just so yeah. the gauge goes up and that's fine.
The old Scott Benjamin maneuver. That's what they call it. It hurts.
No, I'm just kidding. But honestly, like I've rarely been in that position because usually try to plan ahead and get it, you know, so that it's full when you return it, but you don't have to stop at that last stop gas station where they just gouge you every time. So what do you think is the highest you've ever paid, Ben?
Oh, I don't think I've gone up to six, but in a rental car situation, I've gone up to five or maybe $4.50.
Mm-hmm.
But
not uncommon.
And I was scandalized.
And you know, if they do it, if they pump it at the place, you know, I forget what the price is, but it's like, it is like $8.50 or $9 a gallon or something just outrageous. So, yeah, I'd love our European friends to call in and, or to write, call in. I keep saying that the call in, to the live show here. No, but, write in and tell us, you know, roughly what's the fuel price right now over there? Cause we don't have a good sense of that right now.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen over on the other side of the pond or, you know, somewhere else in the world, Australia would be a great example. Write in and let us know what your average gas price is. As we've said before, and you may have heard in a previous episode, we are aware that a large amount of the price or a large percentage of the price in several European countries comes from taxation,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the cost of refinement and transit. It's a tax.
Sure. Yeah. Whereas ours is more if a shipping lane is shut down for a significant amount of time, we feel the pinch over here.
Right. Right. And also, this is an episode for a different show, Scott, but it also makes me wonder. I was talking with some coworkers about how gas or petrol prices affect research on, you know, hybrids and electric cars, economy cars. I'll even throw in solar power, man.
Oh, sure.
Because, you know, every so often we see a solar powered car.
Well, yeah. I mean,
that just kind of creeps along.
Yeah. Those are very, very limited. We've talked about those too, how they're mostly academic.
Like proof of concept.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's mostly for competitions in colleges and things like that.
Right. But with this, you know, you see the point that I'm getting at here. Once the price of a barrel of oil drops below a certain threshold, companies are de-incentivized to continue research and design on these other things.
Well, they're going to go back to the giant vehicles with huge engines,
mm-hmm.
and everybody will go out and, you know, hand over their wallet practically and say, like, take it, you know, because I can afford this vehicle now. But then again, the price will go back up, and then everybody will kind of cut back and say, we want smaller vehicles. It's really a tough position that it puts the manufacturers into a very difficult spot because they don't know what to do. I mean, they try to look at the trends and see where it's going, but who knows at this point?
I still see a lot of manufacturers are going to keep the heavy hitters, right? That's like the heavy hitters that maybe aren't the best in terms of efficiency, but in terms of power, they're knocking out the park. Like the Ford F-150 is not going to go away.
No, neither is the Cadillac Escalade and also the Camaro SS and the Chevy Corvette.
Yeah, here to stay.
They're going to have vehicles like that. The Mustang, of course, the GTs and the Shelbys and
but
all those.
I think those economy cars, the smaller ones, are still going to stick around too, because in a way they're insurance. They're hedging bets,
well,
right?
They have to for the CAFE standards as well.
Yeah, good point.
So, you know, there's so much to talk about when you talk about just the simple thing, the price of, a barrel of fuel.
Yeah.
Or a barrel of oil, rather. That leads to so many other side conversations. I mean, we really could have nearly a month's worth of shows or more just about that.
Scott, that reminds me. First off, we're going to have to make this a two-parter.
I know it. Can you believe it? We've had so many side stories and other things that have come up.
Just kicking our feet
up. We're talking about junk drawers, talking about gorillas.
Shooting the breeze.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of stuff.
So I do have one thing that has absolutely nothing to do with what we were talking about.
Okay.
No. All right. Just a quick question. And it's for you as well, ladies and gentlemen. When you were growing up, did you ever hear that old saying about the price of something in China?
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the price in the saying that you heard?
The price of tea in China?
That's what I always heard.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I always heard. But apparently, and I don't know if this is just a Tennessee thing, my family, they called it the price of eggs in China.
I've heard that before, though, but it was commonly the price of tea in China.
I thought so, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. So maybe there's a regional thing happening.
Well, I'm wondering if it's a regional thing, and this just came about because we were talking about, you know, how the price of a barrel of oil does matter. Mm-hmm. Like in the world we live in today, the price of tea or eggs or oil or another commodity in a foreign country has a profound impact.
You know, it's often that you will hear the price quoted for a gallon of milk. Like a gallon of milk costs X number of dollars or maybe even a loaf of bread.
Or the Big Mac Index. I'm telling you the truth.
The Big Mac Index.
It's a real thing. Have you heard of that?
No, I don't think I have. Isn't there another, there's a Waffle House thing too.
Yeah, that's FEMA.
Okay.
I hand to God, man.
All right.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency informally uses Waffle Houses as an indicator of the level of a disaster, because Waffle Houses always stay open.
Oh, okay. Makes sense.
Unless, you know, the building is literally destroyed.
Sure.
Anyhow, that is a fantastic thing. It makes me wonder if we should talk about disaster vehicles in an upcoming episode. But for part one of Nuts and Bolts 2016, I'd like to thank Miles D, Ryan A, Yijun C, Bob M, Jason G, Scott's father-in-law, that gorilla.
That's crazy, isn't it?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And, of course, you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back next week with the second part of our Nuts and Bolts 2016 episode. We'd like to hear from you. You can give us some feedback on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. Check out every episode we have ever done. And it's a lot out there at carstuffshow.com. And if you want to write to us directly with a story, a question, a suggestion, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.